I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to The Hour of the Time. For those of you who may not realize it, we are also broadcast on satellite. And if you have a satellite dish and a receiving system, you can listen to us in brilliant, stereophonic, high-fidelity sound right in your own home. We're on Galaxy 3, Channel 17, 5.8 wideband audio. That's Galaxy 3, Channel 17, 5.8 wideband audio. Now remember, when you switch over to 5.8 wideband audio, you'll be listening to me. You may be seeing something else on the screen. Don't worry about it. We are on a sub-audio carrier of a video channel. We're also broadcast worldwide over WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio, 5.810 megahertz on your shortwave dial, originating from Nashville, Tennessee. If you have problems with the reception on shortwave, or if you believe that the signal is being intentionally jammed, or any other thing that is not natural, don't call us, call WWCR, folks. And you can find their number just by calling Nashville, Tennessee Information Operator and asking for WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio. Don't forget, we have our conference convention coming up August 1st through the 5th, and it's really going to be a good one, folks. I've been working feverishly here to get everything ready and make sure that it's the best ever held in this country. And if you haven't sent in your registration fee to ensure that you have a place, you better do it right away, because we only have X number of seats in this building, and once they're full, we have to turn anybody else away. So do it now. If you're a CAGI or Intelligence Service member, single registration is $100. If you are an Intelligence Service member with a family membership, it's $150. Anyone else is $250 per person, folks. So take care of it right away. Don't forget, we've reopened membership under the Intelligence Service. Membership for a single membership is $100. Membership for a family, no matter how many family members you have, is $150. We've been sending out the packets. We're sending out the information on the convention or conference for those people who have sent in requesting that information. And all of you should be either have it in your hands or be getting it within the next couple of days. Those of you who have paid for your convention registration fee, you'll be getting a big packet in the mail with all the information on lodging, RV, and camping sites, where to eat, and maps and brochures of all the different things to do around here, plus a little bit about what you're going to be doing here during the convention. Now remember, this is Arizona. If you're coming, bring a hat. Remember that in the daytime, the sun is shining, and if you're not used to being out in the Arizona sun in the absolute crystal clear blue sky, make sure you bring the adequate protection, suntan, lotion, sunblock, and all that kind of stuff. Otherwise, you might get fried. Also, remember, the atmosphere is dry here. There's very little humidity. So you want to bring some kind of a moisturizing cream. For the camp out the last night, you want to bring some warm clothing, because sometimes it gets cool at night, even though it's nice and warm, beautiful in the daytime. Because of the elevation, it sometimes gets cool at night. And you'll want to bring some warm clothing for the camp out. Make sure you bring a sleeping bag for the camp out, or some blankets, or whatever you want to do to sleep out under the stars the last night here. It's going to be a real treat for a lot of you who have never seen the stars in the Arizona sky. It's like a magnifying glass. You'll see stars that you never even dreamed were up there. The Milky Way will look just exactly, ladies and gentlemen, like crystal spread across the sky. It is so beautiful here at night and in the daytime. You'll see shades of blue in the Arizona sky that you've never seen before. You'll see the whitest clouds that you've ever experienced in your life. So, while you may be coming for the conference, there are a lot of other benefits. In fact, I'll bet you some of you, after you've been here, decide to move to some place in Arizona, maybe not St. John's, but I'll bet you that some of you will. It's just a hunch that I have. Stay tuned, folks. Part two of our continuing series on the ADL, which is, in its own way, a part of the Mind Control in America series. For as you see how they have manipulated everyone, you'll begin to understand that what you perceived as reality for most of your life isn't real at all. We're all manipulated. The blacks are manipulated, the whites are manipulated, the Orientals are manipulated, the American Indians are manipulated, the Jews are manipulated. Everyone. No one is exempt from this. Because of human nature, it makes it easy for the puppet masters who pull the strings to make us dance to their tune. Yeah. Gangsters and traitors from the start, ladies and gentlemen. The ADL had been founded shortly after the turn of the century as a Jewish defense arm of the B'nai B'rith. At least that's what the Jews were told. The nominally Jewish secret society, which is sponsored and controlled in all actuality by the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and by some of the leading British and American families who are not Jewish at all, but subscribe to the British Israelite philosophy. B'nai B'rith, Washington, D.C., Representative Simon Wolf, the man whom Lincoln's Secret Service chief, Lafayette C. Baker, had arrested as a Confederate spy and Union blockade runner during the Civil War, was now working closely with President Theodore Roosevelt in mobilizing Jewish American support for the overthrow of the Russian Tsar. According to Wolf's 1918 autobiography, he had met secretly with President Roosevelt in his Sagamore Hills estate in New York and had launched an international drive to brand the Tsarist regime as, quote, anti-Semitic, end quote. They've done the same thing to me, ladies and gentlemen, as you all know. After a series of meetings and correspondence with Russia's Prime Minister, Count Sergei Witt, arranged by Roosevelt, Wolf had denounced the Russian regime for reneging on its promises to curb anti-Jewish pogroms, after which American Jewish organizations, led from behind the scenes by the B'nai B'rith, began funneling guns to the anti-Tsarist insurrectionists. Thus, B'nai B'rith played an active role in the Russian Revolution of 1905. This activity, ladies and gentlemen, would lead to widespread allegations that prominent American Jews were pro-Bolshevik. The Warburg family of Kuhn Loeb and company did, in fact, fund V.I. Lenin and Leon Trotsky, and father and son Bolshevik agents Julius and Armand Hammer, who helped found the U.S. Communist Party, did actively spread the Bolshevik cause in America and spent a decade in the Soviet Union following the 1917 revolution. These allegations of pro-communist sentiments, while grounded in well-publicized and scandalous actions by prominent Jewish families, actually missed the mark. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, the plot to bring down the Tsar and install the Bolsheviks in power in Russia served long-standing British imperial and geopolitical interests of the sort advanced by the Scottish Rite and the Illuminati. Britain, in fact, feared the development of a Eurasian alliance among France, Germany, Russia, Japan, and China based on economic cooperation and facilitated by the building of a transcontinental system of railroads linking the East to the West. Such a transcontinental railroad system would render Britain's domination over the seas relatively unimportant. B'nai B'rith joined in the effort to sink the Tsar for the same reasons the Order joined in the Confederates' secessionist plot to destroy the Union 40 years earlier, because B'nai B'rith was an arm of the Illuminati, Freemasonic treason, and still is. In fact, one of the most compelling reasons for the hatred of Russia was the role played by Tsar Alexander II in coming to the aid of Abraham Lincoln during the darkest days of the United States Civil War. In 1863, Tsar Alexander dispatched the powerful Russian Navy to the United States ports of New York and San Francisco and threatened to go to war against Britain if the Crown joined the war on the side of the Confederacy. This probably, without any public recognition whatsoever, is what eventually enabled the North to win the war, for Britain stayed out. They didn't want to stay out. They were forced to. At the same time, the so-called Jewish Bolshevik ties were being targeted, frequently by people with actual anti-Semitic biases. Diligent local police around the United States were becoming legitimately alarmed at the growing crime problem. New York City Police Commissioner Theodore A. Bingham, in September 1908, penned an article for the prestigious North American Review titled, quote, Foreign Criminals in New York, end quote. The article detailed the rise of gambling, prostitution, and drugs on New York's Lower East Side, emphasizing the role of Jewish, Italian, and Irish immigrant gangsters in that crime explosion. Bingham was not alone in his concern about the rise of gangsterism in the Jewish communities of the metropolitan New York area and beyond. You see, in April 1910, the leading Jewish families of the United States, Germany, France, and Great Britain sent delegates to a Jewish International Convention on the suppression of the traffic in girls and women in London. Keynote speaker Arthur R. Morrow delivered an alarming report on the involvement of Jewish gangsters in the worldwide white slave trade and in big-time prostitution. Now, for those of you who believe that this is all being brought about by the Jews, remember, these were the leading families, the leading Jewish families of the United States, Germany, France, and Great Britain, who sent delegates to a Jewish international convention and brought the spotlight to this illegal and criminal traffic in girls and women. They were not guilty of participation. They, in fact, wanted it stopped. Quote, "I wish I had time to tell you all I know, which goes to show that the traffic of Jewesses is almost worldwide, but I must restrict myself to a few incidents to prove that an extensive traffic does exist. In 1901, a rabbi came from the Transvaal and told me that the amount of Jewish prostitution and traffic in Johannesburg, Pretoria, Lorenco, Marks, Beria, and Salisbury are appalling. In later years, the same story came from another rabbi regarding Cape Town. In 1903, a Jewish schoolmaster who had spent some time in Egypt said that the traffic by Jews of Jewesses to Alexandria, Cairo, and Port Said was an absolute scandal. There were Greek, Italian, and French prostitutes, but they were far outnumbered by the Jewesses. We have received and have correspondence to show that this awful condition of affairs exists in Calcutta to a large extent, and also all along the free ports of China. From the chief rabbi of Constantinople, from a distinguished Jewish American scholar, from a prominent London gentleman, and from a schoolmistress in Kalata, we have had letters during the past 6 months describing an outrageous condition of affairs in Constantinople, where traffic in prostitutes is carried out openly and shamelessly, and where the traffickers have their own synagogue. They say things in Damascus are even worse." End quote. Already in 1909, the leading, quote, "our crowd," end quote, families of New York had established their own Bureau of Social Morals, headed by Rabbi Judah P. Magnus. The Bureau hired private detective Abe Schoenfeld, an investigator for John D. Rockefeller, Jr., to infiltrate and profile the organized crime structure centered on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Schoenfeld's mission was hardly that of crime buster, folks. In 1922, Rabbi Magnus took those voluminous files with him when he moved to Jerusalem and founded the Hebrew University. To this day, the genealogy chart of organized crime remains a part of the university's most closely guarded archives. It was during this same period of mounting concern over the exposure of Jewish surnamed gangsters that the Anti-Defamation League was founded, not to protect the Jewish people, but to protect the Jewish criminal element. One of the very first targets of the ADL was New York Police Commissioner Bingham, whom the ADL smeared as an anti-Semite for his efforts to quell organized crime on the Lower East Side. Bingham's crime-fighting efforts were by no means targeted exclusively against Jewish gangsters. His chief detective, Lieutenant Joseph Petrosino, was assassinated in March 1909 in Sicily while meeting with Italian police to establish cooperation in probing links between criminal elements and anarchist networks operating in both the United States and Italy. In 1901, Petrosino had warned the Secret Service about an imminent assassination attempt against President William McKinley. Petrosino had learned of the plot by infiltrating his agents into the Henry Street Settlement House in New York, a hotbed of British Fabian Society and international anarchist activity. The Secret Service ignored his warnings, and McKinley was assassinated months later, leaving British agent and B'nai B'rith ally Teddy Roosevelt to assume the presidency. The nascent ADL, still formally called the Publicity Committee of the B'nai B'rith, had assailed Bingham's crime-fighting efforts for maligning Jews and eventually succeeded in having him ousted as police commissioner. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, the ADL is not an arm of the Jewish community, but is an arm of a secret society, a branch of the Illuminati, known as B'nai B'rith, which is controlled by the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Organized crime got a big boost as a result. What's more, the effort to establish the links between organized crime, international anarchist circles, and perhaps the Scottish Rite and B'nai B'rith secret societies, was stillborn. The man who founded and headed up the ADL for its first 30 years was Sigmund Livingston, a prominent Chicago attorney who had headed up the powerful B'nai B'rith Midwest Lodge No. 6. Livingston was the lawyer for the Chicago and Alton Railways, a company owned by William Moore of the prominent Episcopalian family. From the 1890s, the Moore family had forged a business alliance with the J.P. Morgan banking interests. The Moores, with Morgan financing, founded the National Biscuit Company, now RJR Nabisco, and United States Steel Corporation. Within two generations, members of the Moore family would also control Bankers Trust Company and sit on the board of the International Business Machines Corporation that you know as IBM. The Moore family sponsorship of Livingston, ADL chairman from 1913 to 1945, was a reflection of the underlying relationship between the leading WASP Freemasonic families and the ADL that continues through to the present. The Moore family's Nabisco and United States Steel are on record today as major financial backers of the Anti-Defamation League. Ironically, Bishop Paul Moore, of the same Moore family, served for years as the Episcopal Bishop of New York. Based at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, he was the superior to Canon Edward West. Now remember, folks, what I've told you about the Cathedral of St. John Divine in the Mystery School series. Canon West's promise to get his Jewish friends to take care of Lyndon LaRouche provided crucial evidence that the real power behind the ADL and its organized crime confederates is the Scottish Rite. With the ADL's successful drive to oust New York Police Commissioner Bingham, organized crime began to spread its tentacles out into New York City and across the country. By the onset of Prohibition in 1920, the undisputed chief of the New York rackets was Arnold Rothstein, the son of a prominent garment manufacturer and a junior member of the elite, quote, Our Crowd, end quote. Many of the Our Crowd families, like the Lehmans, had come to New York from the South in the post-Civil War period. They were transplanted Confederates who capitalized on the power of the British Rothschild family's Wall Street representative, August Belmont, to quickly establish themselves among the city's leading bankers and stockbrokers. They had participated in the unsuccessful Confederate secessionist plot against the Union. Now they would take a leading role in the British effort to direct a new opium war against the American people. Rothstein, ladies and gentlemen, operated a gambling and prostitution syndicate out of the Metropole Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, far from the teeming ethnic ghetto of the Lower East Side. He ran the unofficial gambling commission for Tammany Hall boss Timothy Sullivan. He hobnobbed with some of the country's wealthiest legitimate businessmen, like Julius Fleischman, the yeast manufacturer, Joseph Seagram, the Canadian distiller, Harry Sinclair of the Sinclair Oil Company, and Percival H. Hill, head of the American Tobacco Company. In 1919, Rothstein engineered the fixing of the Baseball World Series on behalf of his gambling cronies in what became known as the Chicago Black Sox scandal. At the behest of Lower East Side gangster Irving Wexler, also known as Waxy Gordon, and Detroit mobster Max Greenberg, Rothstein put up the initial $175,000 to establish the first bootlegging operations of the Prohibition era, servicing the Midwest and the East Coast with British whiskey transported across the Atlantic. rum-running ships owned by Rothstein and his partners would smuggle the British whiskey from Long Island Sound into the U.S. Rothstein's British contacts included Winston Churchill, who at the time headed the Royal Commission in charge of liquor. In 1921, Rothstein also opened up a British pipeline for smuggling heroin into the United States via his business agent in China, Jacob Katzenberg. Katzenberg hooked up with the British opium cartel, then headed by Lord Keswick of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation and the Jardine and Matheson Trading Company, and arranged the transit of the illegal drugs through Marseille into New York City. The route, later known as the French Connection, would remain the primary pipeline of heroin into America up through the 1960s. The period of Prohibition, folks, marked the syndication of organized crime. It also marked the emergence of illegal money as a major source of investment capital in so-called legitimate business. As the proceeds of the billions of dollars in illegal whiskey and dope sales were funneled into such lucrative straight investments as the Hollywood, motion picture, and music industries, the Nevada gambling casinos — Nevada conveniently legalized casino gambling just as Prohibition was coming to an end — and post-Prohibition legal alcohol distilleries, the ADL, was on hand to directly reap the benefits. In 1929, ladies and gentlemen, one of Meyer Lansky's New York City crime lieutenants, Frank Erickson, founded the Sterling National Bank. Erickson was a specialist in money laundering. After Lansky replaced Arnold Rothstein, for he was assassinated in 1926, as the chairman of the board of the National Crime Syndicate, Erickson had been put in charge of the nationwide bookkeeping operations. Erickson handled Lansky's hidden interests in gambling casinos, racetracks, and other businesses around the country. Sterling National Bank served as the mob's factor bank in the New York City Garment Center, doling out high-interest short-term loans to thousands of small clothing manufacturers to purchase their raw materials. The loans were collateralized by the garment firm's accounts receivable. On paper, it was a benign, barely legal form of loan sharking. The victims were Jews. In practice, it was the syndicate's foot in the door for taking over the entire garment industry through violence and intimidation. Again, the victims were Jews. Erickson's relationship with Lansky gave Sterling virtually unchallenged control over the garment center. In 1934, Theodore H. Silbert went to work for Sterling National Bank. Within a decade of his arrival, Silbert was the bank's chairman, president, and CEO, posts he would retain up until his death in early 1992. You see, Silbert was the ADL's man on the scene. He would serve as the ADL's national commissioner, treasurer, and chief fundraiser. The ADL established its bank accounts at Sterling National, and according to IRS records, invested in bank stock. The only other outside investment into which the ADL would ever put its own money would be the American Bank and Trust Company, another New York City bank, which listed ADL National Commissioner and B'nai B'rith International President Philip Klutznick as a director. ABT would go under when shady Mossad financier Davy Gravier made off with all the bank's deposits and then ostensibly died in a mysterious airplane crash over Mexico. Gravier's so-called death was so suspect that New York State listed him as a co-conspirator in the ABT bank fraud investigation for years. For you see, they didn't then, and they don't believe now, that he really died in that plane crash. Although Silbert's emergence as the leading figure at Sterling National was part of a campaign to cleanse the bank's public image by replacing a known gangster with a philanthropist and civic-minded banker, Sterling continued to be entangled in shady financial dealings, sometimes leading to high-visibility civil suits. The most explosive of these scandals hit in January 1982, when the Italian government filed suit in United States District Court in New York City against Sterling. charging it with constructive trust conspiracy to defraud, fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. The case, ladies and gentlemen, revolved around Italian banker Michele Sindona's looting of $27 million from the Banca Privata in 1973-74. The theft had repercussions across the Atlantic as well. The Franklin National Bank on Long Island, New York, went bust as the result of Sindona's involvement. Sterling National Bank was one of the laundromats through which Sindona washed the stolen cash. Folks, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. They specialize in non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets. The only thing in history that is proven to hold its value no matter what the economy does. You see, you can buy the same number of loaves of bread today with 1 ounce of gold that you could in 1862 or in 1710. Are in the year 1236. And you'll still be able to buy the same number of loaves of bread with 1 ounce of gold in the year 2078 as you can today. Now gold will fluctuate on the market, so will silver. It's directly proportionate to the value of the dollar in relation to foreign currency. Now remember, very little of the currency in the world has any actual value other than the paper that it's printed upon. The value of gold, when it fluctuates, is a direct reflection of the confidence or the lack of confidence in the paper currency that the people are using at the time. You can invest, and you can exploit these fluctuations if you have some kind of a crystal ball, or if you're on the inside and you know when they're going to sell large amounts of gold or buy large amounts of gold against the fluctuation, the value of the currency. And you might be able to make a killing, or you might be able to lose everything you have, especially if you're leveraging your investment. We recommend that you invest in hard assets not to make a killing, folks, because I don't believe in taking that kind of a chance with your family's financial security. but I believe that you should invest in hard assets to protect the value of the assets that you have. The dollar continues to decline. It will continue to decline. Eventually, it will collapse. It can do nothing else. So call Swiss America Trading right now. Do something to protect yourself and what you have spent many good years of your life earning to provide for the future of yourself and your family. Look around at your loved ones now, right this moment. Look them right in the eye. If you can tell them that they are protected against whatever may come, then you don't need to do this. But if you can't, you must. You owe it to yourself and your family to at least investigate the means of protecting what you have against what is sure to come. Now, if you don't like Swiss America Trading, or if you don't like me, or if you don't like the hour or the time, then call somebody else. But at least do something to protect yourself and your loved ones. And do it now. You'll be glad that you did. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Call now, folks. It'll be a great, great weight off your shoulders. You'll be able to rest peacefully, and your family will have a much stronger faith in your ability to lead them. 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. Is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. Grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve about and you can't make a run.
Folks, tonight's program is based upon a report by the Executive Intelligence Review, a special report by the editors of the Executive Intelligence Review. This report was first published in 1992, entitled The Ugly Truth About the ADL. It has taken CAGI this long to duplicate the research and verify that every single fact in here is absolutely 100% correct and true. The fact that none of the people, nor the ADL, has ever sued the Executive Intelligence Review over this information further substantiates the value and the truthfulness of this report. This is not an anti-Semitic report. It is an anti-ADL, anti-secret society, B'nai B'rith, controlled by the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, a racist organization promoting the concept of the British Israelism concept that the Anglo-Aryan race is superior to all others. Indeed, has a special covenant with God and all this other baloney. And folks, it is baloney. Someday you will all wake up to that fact. Not surprisingly, Sindona would later be exposed as a pivotal figure in the propaganda to Freemasonic Lodge, a secret Italian branch of the Scottish Rite with strong ties to the Mafia. Its antecedent, the 19th century Propaganda One Lodge, had been founded by Giuseppe Mazzini, the founder of the Sicilian Mafia, as a branch of the European Illuminati. A leading member of the First Communist International and an agent of Britain's Lord Palmerston, the Grand Master of the Scottish Rite. Giuseppe Mazzini was in close communication with the Confederate General Albert Pike, who was the head of the Illuminati in the United States. Some things, folks, just never, ever change. The ADL's shady links to Sterling National Bank went beyond Theodore Silbert. Another longtime director of the bank, an ADL man, Maxwell Robb, was a business partner of Meyer Lansky in a company called the International Airport Hotel Corporation. The vice chairman of the powerful New York State ADL, Robb weathered the public airing of his Lansky links and went on to be the United States ambassador to Italy during the Reagan administration. Talk about putting the fox in the hen house. Arnold Burns was another ADL asset on the board of Sterling. Burns' law firm, Burns and Summit, got caught up in a tax evasion scheme in the early 1980s that almost landed both partners in jail. Under a loophole in the federal tax codes written into law thanks to the Zionist lobby in the United States Congress, American investors in Israel research and development firms could claim their investments as tax write-offs. But nobody else could, investing in the same type of business in other countries and in the United States. Arnold Burns set up a string of tax shelters in the Bahamas, ostensibly to fund these Israeli research and development projects. However, the money, minus a hefty fee to Burns and Summit, never, ever reached Israel. It was laundered right back into the United States where it could be used by its own owners, tax-free. And when the scheme became the subject of a federal grand jury in New York, Burns pointed a finger at some of his cohorts and walked away, completely unscathed. A few months later, Arnold Burns was named Deputy Attorney General of the United States, a post he held throughout most of the Reagan era, Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America. Burns's name had been placed before Ronald Reagan by John J. McCloy, a powerhouse in the New York City white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment, a leading Anglophile, British Israelist, ex-head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the former chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank. Nor is Sterling National Bank the only ADL bank implicated in the dope trade and organized crime. Leonard Abbas of Miami, Florida, is another honorary national chairman of the ADL. He's the chairman of City National Bank of Miami, one of many Florida banks caught laundering big-time drug money. A top aide to Abbas at City National, Alberto Duke, was jailed in the late 1980s for laundering dope dollars. Another senior bank official, Donald Beasley, was hired by Abbas on the basis of his former work for the Nugan Hand Bank in Australia. And if you've read my book, you know all about Nugan Hand Bank and the Central Intelligence Agency and the laundering of drug money. Nugan Hand went bust in the mid-1980s when one of its founders, Frank Nugan, was found dead in his car, the victim of what police labeled a suicide. And the other partner, former Green Beret and CIA agent Michael Hand, a veteran of Delta Force, disappeared into thin air with $26 million in bank assets. Nugan Hand had been set up during the final days of the Vietnam War by ex-Central Intelligence Agency and Pentagon officers, including Ted Shackley, to launder black market profits and do shady intelligence operations throughout Asia. In the 1985, Moe Dalitz Award Dinner was a kind of coming-out party for the ADL's friends in the National Crime Syndicate. It was, ladies and gentlemen, by no means the first time the League publicly flaunted its deep ties to the gangster world. You see, in 1963, as part of an effort to vastly expand its fundraising reach, the ADL appointed Hollywood producer Dore Sherry as its national chairman. At the time, Sherry was the reigning superstar at the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. Among the Hollywood insiders, however, Sherry was known as a lifelong pal of syndicate higher-up Abner Longy Zwillman of New Jersey. Zwillman was one of the first of the Prohibition-era bootleggers and Lansky aides to get involved in the Hollywood motion picture industry, an original member of Murder Incorporated, and the head of the powerful Rheinfeld bootlegging syndicate in New Jersey. Zwillman expanded into labor racketeering during the waning days of Prohibition. And by 1930, he had seized control over the Screen Operators Union up and down the East Coast and parlayed that into shares in some of the big Hollywood studios. And you don't think there's any mind control in America? At this time, Dore Sherry ran an amateur drama group at the YMHA in Newark, New Jersey. Childhood friend Zwillman sent Sherry out to the West Coast and installed him at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM. When Zwillman got into trouble with the IRS in the late 1950s, some of his syndicate associates became convinced that he might betray some of the mob's most closely held financial secrets. And on February the 27th, 1959, he was found hanging from a pipe in the basement of his 20-room West Orange, New Jersey mansion. According to Federal Bureau of Investigation reports, Sherry attended the funeral. In the FBI memo citing Sherry's appearance at the Zwillman funeral, the Bureau delivered a kind of eulogy to the mobster, citing an article from the New York World Telegram. The FBI memo read, quote, "Nobody followed so successfully for so long the approved underworld formula for success, from rags to rackets to riches to respectability," end quote. And folks, if the rags to respectability formula were to be applied to organizations, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith would be first on the list of success stories. For the past two decades, Wall Street lawyer Kenneth Bailkin has been Mr. ADL, a long-standing member of the League's National Executive Committee. Bailkin served from 1982 through 1986 as the League's national chairman. It was on his watch that gangster Moe Dalitz got the ADL's prestigious, quote, Torch of Liberty, end quote, prize. That junk bond swindler Michael Milken poured millions of dollars into the launching of the League's A World of Difference propaganda campaign to wreck American public education, and that accused drug money launderer Edmund Safra got Bailkin and the ADL to mediate a corporate divorce between his banking empire and the American Express Company. In return for Bailkin's effort to salvage Safra's badly tarnished reputation, the ADL received a $1 million tax-exempt payoff from him. But Bailkin's real claim to fame, folks, is that he was a central figure in the doping, the drugging of America. Without Kenneth Bailkin's behind-the-scenes legal maneuvering, the Medellin cartel would have had a far more difficult time establishing a beachhead in the United States. In much the same way Bailkin quieted the potentially stormy divorce between Edmund Safra and American Express, he brokered the marriage between renegade financier Robert Vesco and the Medellin cartel's chief of logistics, Carlos Leder Rivas. As a result, The dope smuggling routes through the Caribbean into the United States were consolidated, and the streets of America were flooded during the 1980s with marijuana and cocaine. Now, this sordid story began in 1970, when Kenneth Bailkin, the senior partner at the Wall Street law firm of Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, helped engineer Robert Vesco take over the Investors Overseas Service, a Swiss-based mutual fund that was founded by Bernie Kornfield with startups funding from the Swiss-French branch of the Rothschild family. IOS was a front for Meyer Lansky's international crime syndicate. IOS salesmen traveled the globe carrying suitcases full of cash across international borders. Some of the money came from local investors, but the bulk of it was hot money gained from the Lansky syndicate's dope gambling, prostitution, and extortion rackets. Now, if this method of money laundering was labor-intensive and primitive compared to today's high-speed electronic wire transfers, it was nevertheless efficient. The cash eventually wound up in numbered accounts at some of Switzerland's most corrupt and secretive banks. Some of the banks, ladies and gentlemen, linked to the IOS apparatus, like the Geneva-based International Credit Bank, or BCI, and the Nassau, Bahamas-based Bank of World Commerce, were flagrant fronts for the Lansky Syndicate. While BCI was owned by a senior officer of the Israeli Mossad named Tibor Rosenbaum, BCI's office manager, Sylvian Ferdman, was identified by Life magazine in 1967 as one of Lansky's top bagmen, and World Commerce director Alvin Malnick was Lansky's accountant. When Lansky and his controllers decided to shift the center of their underground banking operations from Switzerland to the Caribbean, as part of the planned expansion of cocaine and marijuana smuggling into the United States, with the cooperation and the help of the intelligence community and the military, it was the ADL and Bailkin that engineered the move. First, the ADL's Minneapolis, Minnesota apparatus, known inside the league as the Minneapolis Mafia, which ran the notorious Kid Can, or Isidore Blumenfeld, organized crime ring, provided the money for a local Hebrew schoolteacher turned business entrepreneur named Meshulam Rickless to buy up a large block of shares of IOS stock. Once Rickless had amassed enough stock to control the company, he turned around and sold all his shares to Vesco. Vesco was represented in the transaction by Kenneth Bailkin. You see, the circle is now complete. Vesco's next step was to oust Bernie Kornfield as the president of IOS and take over the job himself. Over the next several years, ladies and gentlemen, a total of $270 million was siphoned out of IOS accounts in Switzerland. Officially, the money was never found, and Robert Vesco conveniently fled the United States one step ahead of the FBI and the IRS. The Kornfield to Rickless to Vesco transaction may have been largely a wash of Lansky syndicate dollars. From Prohibition onward, the Minneapolis Kid Can gang had been handlers of Lansky money. Kid Can eventually moved to the Miami area and was a key player in Lansky's big-time move into Southern Florida Gold Coast real estate. However, folks, not all of the money siphoned out of IOS by Vesco was family cash. A lawsuit was brought in U.S. District Court in New York City in 1980 by some of the independent investors who had lost their shirts in the looting of IOS. While not revealing the whereabouts of the missing millions, the civil suit identified Bailkin and the Bank of New York as partners of the fugitive financier in the scheme. On July 31, 1980, federal judge D.J. Stewart ordered Wilkie Farr and Gallagher to pay $24.5 million to a group of IOS investors and ordered the Bank of New York to pay $35.6 million. The case file, which fills 20 cartons stored at the Federal District Court Warehouse in Bayonne, New Jersey, shows that Bailkin, was the evil genius behind the entire looting scheme. A year before the court ordered Wilkie Farr and the Bank of New York to pay up for their role in the looting of IOS, some of that money had been used by Vesco to purchase Norman's Cay in the Bahamas. Vesco's partner in the deal was Carlos Letter Rivas, a small-time Colombian car thief and marijuana smuggler who had recently gotten out of jail in Florida. Letter, an unabashed supporter of Adolf Hitler, who would later use some of his smuggling profits to found a neo-Nazi radical environmentalist political party in Colombia, fit neatly into the ADL scheme with his family ties back in Colombia to leading figures in the then-emerging Medellin cartel. By 1980, the Vesco Letter-owned Norman's Cay was serving as the command center and transshipment depot for a massive marijuana and cocaine trafficking operation protected by the intelligence community from Medellin into the United States. For several years, while running the Norman's Cay operation, Vesco skipped from the Bahamas to Costa Rica to Nicaragua, buying up local politicians and newspaper editors, and always miraculously staying one step ahead of an FBI that never really seemed intent upon capturing the fugitive money man. In fact, it was just a show. On one occasion, on Antigua, Vesco was hosting a lavish party on a boat that he had bought from Saudi financier Adnan Khashoggi. Isn't it funny how the same names always crop up in all of these investigations? While the FBI agents were combing the island, looking for this elusive fugitive. Well, I hope you can sleep well tonight. I hope you're beginning to get the message. I hope you're beginning to understand. Things just ain't as you thought they were. And they use this branding of anti-Semitic, anti-Semitism, to control the Jews and to keep you in your place. You see, you will learn later in this series that when the ADL needs to rally the Jewish community around a cause, it is the ADL itself which sprays the swastika on Jewish synagogues and on their gravestones in their cemeteries. Good night, and God bless you all.
There's homeless on the streets of every city. Big city crime in every little town. There's people making money off Jesus, and taxes dragging everybody down. There's politicians kind of stretching the truth, and farmers are getting pulled up by the roots, and pushers telling little kids how the only way. Oh, welcome to the USA today. It's true, we got our problems. Lord knows we make mistakes, and every time still knocks on every door. Our younger generation's really shining, much brighter than they've ever shined before. to vote them out again. And we're all free to speak our mind and not get locked away. Welcome to the USA Today.
If you believe all that, folks, you're not playing with a full deck. Good night. See you tomorrow night. Don't miss it.